Okay, we are just coming on to 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and stop the share, and I will mute all. And as usual, everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves if you have a question or comment. Please remute yourself afterwards, keep background noise to a minimum. And later on this evening, thanks to Alan, the contents of the deck presented tonight in PDF format, the chat, and the audio track will be posted on our website. And we have lots of material here tonight, so I will kick it right over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. And he's going to kick it back to me. Alan, you're muted, just by the way. But I'll go ahead and start it off. So this is just a repeat of last week's reminder about the social get-together that we're having. Wednesday, November 26th, so rather than Q&A that night, we will be gathering at the bar. And so the location is going to be Big Rig in Gloucester Center. And it's a convenient location. You can get to it easily off the 174. You can get to it easily from the O train or by driving. There's lots of parking in that that lot. So we'll be making the arrangements. And so we will be calling the bar with the numbers to be reserved. And we'll be doing that on November 13th. So November 12th is the deadline for getting in an email to suggestion box if you plan to attend. So please do so. We only have, I think, about half a dozen so far that have indicated that they want to come. So please be sure to go ahead and send in that email if you hope to come. It's not a commitment, but if you hope to come, please do give us an email. And I'll kick it back to Alan,
who is now unmuted and can talk. Okay, we had a question came in about passwords on Google, and this individual tried to log into Google Groups but found that the password was invalid. And however, she says that she's had the same password for absolute years, but she noticed that it wasn't strong, and she's wondering whether Google actually forces people to choose stronger passwords. Now, personally, I've not had that happen to me, but if anybody knows anything about that, you can let us know in the chat, or later on we'll have an open mic and you can tell us all about it. Second question was about Kaji.com. This is a search engine for which you actually pay for. It's a subscription service. And ask, if you don't know anything about it, there's this Ask Leo video where he talks about the fact that he's using Kaji to basically stop adverts. I mean, that's what you do. You pay for the thing, but now you don't get these sponsored adverts all over your hit list. Anyway, again, the question was, has anybody in the club ever used Kaji.com? So once again, if you know anything about that, then let us know in the chat window, or we'll come back to it later on. Okay, next up, another question, really, from Sherida. She says that this, it's a probably too simple a question, but the question is, how do you create a zip file, and then how do you open it? And Chris has a couple of comments here. He says, first of all, simple questions are not necessarily simple, and we can always learn something usually from things. And even simple things, you know, you may use a product and you think you know all about it, but there are often things that hidden in the background that you actually don't know about. So we're going to spend a few minutes right now talking about zip files and how you create them and how you open them. And I think everybody probably knows that a zip file is really a container. So it has two functions, basically. One is to archive, which is basically putting a whole bunch of different files together and packaging them into a single zip file. But at the same time, the individual files are compressed, and that means that you reduce the size of everything, generally, so that your zip archive is multiple files in a smaller package, essentially. So that's one of the advantages, is that now you have one package that's easy to distribute. And because everything is compressed, it will upload and download faster than if you were doing the original files by themselves. And the good thing about ZIP is that it's been adopted by just about everybody. It's kind of the standard archiver these days, I think. So if you're using Windows, Linux, or even Mac, and you can use ZIP files. ZIP's been around for a long time, or at least compression has been around for a long time. You may have heard of the Huffman coding algorithm, which was developed by a mathematician in 1952, and that was basically the basis of this lossless compression technique. So you're looking for strings which are basically duplicated, and then you can use a single entity to represent the individual string, and so you save space on multiple strings. That's kind of one of the ways that things work. Unix, of course, had all kinds of different utilities, and one of them was called Compress, which they developed in the 70s. And they used this LZUW compression. And however, it was only applicable to a single file. So you had a compressed file, but not an archive of compressed files. And then in 85, System Enhancement Associates developed ARP, which is just short for archive format. And they basically developed a technique to compress the individual files and then store multiple files into one archive. So that was the first kind of ZIP package, if you like. So Phil Katz, who developed, he has a company called PKWare, or had a company called PKWare, and he developed this program called PKARC, which was an upgrade essentially to ARC. But he got sued by SEA and basically lost the lawsuit. So he and Gary Conway created a brand new compression utility from scratch. And this is essentially ZIP, of course. And he released the specification for that into the public domain. So it's a readily available file format. And one of his colleagues, this Richard Mahoney, suggested ZIP. And what he was trying to indicate was that ZIP files were going to run much faster than ARC, so it was a superior product. However, PKZIP did in fact, or the ZIP file format became the go-to file archiving system. So basically a ZIP file has a whole bunch of components, and there's a file header, and that has some data in there, some metadata, which tells the program that's trying to open it the compression method, and it has checksums for validation and that kind of stuff. And then there's the actual file data, so the individual files in their compressed format are stored away in a compartment, if you like. And then there's an optional data description. And then the central directory is essentially an index. So this lists the file names, their attributes, and where they are in the ZIP. So programs trying to interrogate the ZIP file can work with it. And interestingly enough, if you look at a ZIP file header, you'll still find the initials PK, apparently, in the file header for Phil Katz. So longevity at its finest there. So basically, you have these individual files, they're compressed, but there's a checksum calculator, the cyclic redundancy check, checksum, and basically make sure that when the file's restored, then it's an accurate restoration of the original file. And because you have this central directory, you can add or remove individual files without having to decompress the whole archive. So it's much quicker if you want to just add a single file to a big archive. You just write, the program just writes new header information and that does the trick. And again, because you've got this header information and the central directory records, then this assures that when you recover the files, you get accuracy and also the access is relatively fast. Now, over and above those original features, people have added all kinds of different things. So now there are lots of third-party type programs. You see some of the things they do here. You can embed comments in a zip file. You can have encryption and you can password protect the file. You can use Unicode for the file name, so you have lots of different characters that you can use. You can support larger files. You can split one archive into multiple components, which was useful when people were using CDs. Some of the programs will also let you set the compression algorithm that you want to use. So then you can choose, do I want speed or do I want high compression or do I want some kind of balance? So you can select the compression algorithm to suit your particular purposes. One of the interesting things is that there's a whole bunch of non-zip files which are really zip files, and good examples are Microsoft Office, the .docx and .xlx files, for example, but also LibreOffice, the Open Document Format, ODT and ODS. As Chris pointed out to me, these are actually zip files. They're really zip containers, and they've got all kinds of modules inside them, including XML files and other resources. And I actually make use of this in a Python program that can extract the data from an ODT file, edit it, and then fire it back and create a new PDF file. So it's a really neat way to be able to update a zip file, or an ODT file in this case. But there are some other ones that you might recognize there, APK, the Android Distribution System, XPIs, if you downloaded extensions for Firefox, and XPS, for example, for XML specification files. Now, when it comes to zipping and unzipping files, Windows has a zip utility built in, as does Linux Mint. Linux Mint has something called the Archive Manager, which is a program, but it basically does the same thing. However, we're all probably familiar with third-party utilities, and some of the ones I've listed here, and 7-Zip and PZIP, which are open-source packages and hence free. And then some of the pay-for packages, or I guess they have free versions, and then they have their pro versions, WinZip and WinRAR. And typically they will give you higher compression than, say, 7-Zip, for example. Okay, so moving on, I'm going to turn it over to Chris, and he's going to talk about zip files in Windows.
Yeah, so Alan did mention a number of programs out there for handling zip files. You don't necessarily need them, maybe. The ability to deal with zip files is actually built into Windows 10 and 11. And if you want to create a zip file in either Windows 10 or 11, you can go to select all of the files that you want to put into a zip file, and then you can right-click, and you can go to the Send To menu, and then after that you go to, from the pop-up menu, Compressed Zipped Folder. Now, there's a chance that certainly if you're in Windows 11, you may actually have to go to the Show More Options when you right-click on the files before you will get that Send To Compressed Folder option. So then it'll automatically create the zip file from that. It will name it according to the last file that you selected, if you selected a group of files, and it'll just create it by that name, .zip. And it comes up with it already selected, so you can actually just easily rename it by just starting typing in the name that you want the zip file to actually have. Now, in Windows 11 only, you will have an option, if you right-click, you'll have an option Compress To. You still have the Send To Compress Folder, but you have this new option Compress To, and the first option is a zip file. We're not going to cover off the 7-Zip or TAR in here, but you feel free to explore those if you want. One thing I will point out is if you go to the additional options, Avoid the options that say retain symbolic links or retain hard links unless you really know what you're doing, because in essence what you're going to end up with is none of the data will be in that file. It'll actually, the zip file will just contain pointers to the actual data, and that will only work on your computer where you're creating it. So avoid those options unless you really understand what's going on. So how do you actually use zip files within Windows? Well, all you have to do is double-click on the zip file, and it will open up as if it's a folder containing the files within that. And it just looks like any other folder, really, other than on the title bar, you'll actually see, in this case, you have videoclip.zip, so you know you're actually looking within a zip file. Now, you can access the files within the zip by just double-clicking the file, and it'll open up just like you would open up any regular file, sort of. There's a caveat to that we'll come back to in a minute. You're better off to actually just copy all the files to a regular folder and then access them in that folder, or all the files you want. You don't necessarily have to be dealing with all of the files in that zip file. You could just copy out an individual file or a couple of files if you wanted. Just select whatever you want, copy, and paste them into another folder. So after using the zip file, so after you open it up, you can add or delete files to a zip file just like you would a normal file. So here we see that I'm copying MondayLisa.jpg into it by just dragging it and dropping it into that opened up zip file, which is that folder that looks like it's a folder, and you just drop it in and it'll add it to it. You'll get this dialog box coming up saying that it's adding it or compressing it, and then you'll see that now videoclip.zip actually contains three files, so the original two plus the JPEG file. And you can delete files from it by just selecting it and select delete, whatever. Just treat it as if it's a normal folder. So there's one problem that is a possible thing that will come up and bite you, and that's you can access the files by double-clicking on them, and it will open them up. But what it happens is it'll decompress that file to a temporary folder, and then it'll run that file. If you have file dependencies, you can get errors. An example would be this, where I have videoclip.pptx. So that is a PowerPoint presentation file that is within this videoclip.zip file. Okay? So it's actually it's linked to a file called paulferrat.mp4, which also exists within the zip file. Okay? So I might send this to somebody, and they can then access the PowerPoint file, and if they open it up correctly, they can actually run the PowerPoint file, it will find the linked file in the same folder and actually do it. But if you only double-click on the file itself, it is only going to open up that one file, it'll decompress it to a temporary folder, and then run it. And when I try to run that presentation, I'll get media not found. Because in that temporary folder where it's decompressed the PowerPoint file to, the MP4 file doesn't exist. Okay, so that's why I say that it's better if you actually copy all of the files to a regular folder and then access them, just in case there are any file dependencies like that. Okay, for encryption on zip files, this is another thing where Windows sort of does a little bit, but not enough for most cases. So encrypting a zip file is really great if you want to have sensitive information. So the password is required to access the files within the zip file. And an important thing to note is that the directory is not encrypted. It's only the actual contents of the files. So if you encrypt a zip file, people can still see the names of the files within it. So if you had a zip file that was complaining about my coworkers, and within it you have a samspade.doc, anybody who accesses that, they might not be able to access the actual file, but they could see the file name. So just be a little bit cognizant of that. Windows Zip Handler cannot create encrypted zip files. Okay, so you can extract files from an encrypted zip file that was created with a different program, but not all the time. It turns out that it's using the original zip specification when it's unzipping things. So if it sees that it's encrypted, it will try to decrypt it using what is known as zip crypto, which is a relatively weak algorithm for encryption. Later implementations in ZIP include things like AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, for much more robust encryption. Unfortunately, if you try to open up some ZIP file that was encrypted using AES using the native Windows tools, it won't be able to decrypt the files. So Windows not only can't create encrypted ZIP files, it can only extract files from encrypted files if it was using ZipCrypto, which most people are actually using higher grades of encryption if they are encrypting ZIP files. So the bottom line is, if you're using encryption with ZIP files, you're probably better off using a third-party program to handle your ZIP files rather than the built-in Windows facility for that. And I'll turn it back over to Helen.
And speaking of which, one third-party option is 7-Zip. And here's the homepage. And I've actually been using this rather than the Windows one. And if you've been following the newsletter, you'll have seen my Trading Up to Linux series, which has been, was running basically for the last year. And I tried to leverage that by having it published in Full Circle magazine, which is an online publication out of the UK. So I sent the guy my docx file, which has the text and the graphics and all the formatting and stuff. But he found that there were problems. He had problems actually opening it for some reason. So what he wanted was a simple text file and then the images in a separate document. So what you can see here is I've taken the doc file and I've extracted the text as a text file. I've extracted the images as PNGs, but I've also created a PDF file. So I can send him a PDF file to show him how I would like the content to be formatted. Well, now I've got the number of files I want to send him, so clearly I don't need to, but it's easier, again, using that archiving technique and sending him a package. So you can probably see here what I've done is I've highlighted the files that I want to send. I right-click, it brings up this context menu, and I select 7-Zip, and then I tell it to add it to the archive. Alternatively, I can just run 7-Zip. This is the main program window. I can navigate down to my folder, highlight the files I want to zip, and tell it to, by hitting the plus sign, tell it I want to add these files to the archive. Either way, I think I just skipped a slide there maybe. Yeah, either way, I get this option to add the files to the archive. And you can see here that you've got a whole bunch of different options that we've been talking about. You can choose the archive format, and I'm going to just leave it as zip, but you can choose the compression level, the deflation, the compression method. You can split it into various volumes by size. You can encrypt it by entering a password here. All kinds of weird and wonderful options. If you don't care about that, you just accept the default file name, zip file name, say OK, and it will create a trading09.zip file. So now if I pull that out and I've done Chris's technique here. I put the zip into a temporary folder, test folder. I've highlighted the zip file, just the extract. I would have to give it passwords and stuff if I'd use them here. But I'm happy with the default, so I just say okay. And what it's done is it's created a trading09 subfolder. So if I open that, you can see that here is my original text file, the three PNG files, and the PDF file. So my editor in the UK is going to be happy because he's got what he wanted. So ZIP is a really useful file format, and there are all kinds of different things you can do with it, as we've kind of indicated. Okay, I don't know if there's anything in the chat, Chris.
Lots of comments about different formats and things like that. So if people want to delve more into different programs that can do things, you might want to check out the chat for some of the comments on it.
Yep. Okay. All right. So next up, we have a share from Linda, our photo guru.
And she's going to unmute herself.
I am unmuted.
There you go.
Okay. Thanks very much, Alan. So this photo ephemeris website is a celestial tool. And before you tune me out because you think, oh, I don't take pictures of the sun or the moon or the stars or anything like that, keep listening because it's a very useful tool for any kind of travel photography. So I'll get to that. So basically, it's an online tool that relative to what date you put in and your selected location, it will tell you where and when the sun is rising and setting, where and when the moon is rising and setting, the altitude angle of the sun and moon, and the path as it, you know, moves through the day, the sun and the moon. So it's free on the website, and you can upgrade to a pro version. I'm not sure what all is involved in the pro version. They used to have an Android app for sale. Unfortunately, now the only app available is for an Apple phone or tablet. But I do have an alternative on the next page. So that's the main website for photoephemeris.com. So next. So how to use the website? Well, basically, you're going to search first on your desired location of where you want to see these things, these sun, moon, etc. Then you're going to select the date using the calendar, and you can go backwards, which is great because you've taken a photo or something, you're not sure exactly, you want to repeat that, where was the sun, you can go backwards in the calendar. You can click on any of the little sort of icons that they have for sunrise, sunset, moonrise, etc. And you can drag a bottom slider for the exact time of day and to also see the transit, the path that the sun is taking during the day or the moon. So if you do want an Android app, I tend to do my research before, and when I'm traveling, I'm often roaming, so I don't have any issues with going to the website. But if you do want an Android app, there's another celestial app called PhotoPills. It does all the same things that this one does, plus more. You can see where the Milky Way is going to be and things like that. So it's $15, and you can see an old OPCUG article on astronomy apps, if you want to. Next. So getting back to PhotoEphemeris, this is what it looks like on the website. So this is Petrie Island in Orleans. Next. So basically you're going to, on the right search button there, on the right, you can put in whatever location you want. And as I say, you select the time or the date and year on the left. And then it drops in this little red pin to the location it thinks what it decides is Petrie Island, which is fine. And then along the bottom, you have these squares that will tell you different things. Next, just to highlight a couple of them. So the civil start is basically the last part of the blue hour. So before the sun comes up, you might have more often heard it called blue hour than civil start, but the civil start isn't quite a full hour. And then the sunrise. So it tells you exactly when the sunrise is going to happen. And then the golden hour, et cetera, moonrise. And then at the other end of the day, the sunset, and then the blue hour after sunset. And then you can see below that there's a graph that gives you the angle of the sun or moon at any time of day. Okay, so you see the degrees that the sun is in the sky. So that's helpful at different times of the year. And then the bottom slider I'll get to in the next slide. So next. So this is just showing you what you can do. So it plunked it at Petrie Island. That might not have been exactly where I wanted it, but that's okay. You can just drag the red pin. And for instance, here I dragged it right off of Petrie Island and put it on the main mainland. And so then that orange line is where the sun is going to set. The yellow line is where the sun is going to come up. So you can decide, depending on the time of year, am I going to have the sun come up over the water, or is it going to be all back in the trees because it's too close to fall? Okay, and so that's how I plan my blue hours. Where's the sun actually going to come up? And in the spring, it's actually coming up in this particular area of the Ottawa River. It actually comes up on the Quebec side. So I can plan my life around it. Okay, next. So if you want to change your location, you can just type in a new location. The app has, or the website has, a huge number of Canadian. I've put in teeny tiny bays in Newfoundland, or well-known things like Cabot Tower, not a particular location. It seems to find them all. But if you prefer, you can just scroll back out on the map and drag your pin, say, over to Nova Scotia if you're going to look for Peggy's Cove and you don't want to type it in. Next. So then when I saw it kind of ended up in Halifax area, so I just dragged it over to where Peggy's Cove was, and that allows me to see where the sun is going to rise and set, etc. So next. So this gives me a great idea. So I can think, well, gee, I know exactly where that lighthouse is, so the best time for me to get the sun behind the lighthouse is sunset, because at sunrise it's the other way, and I would have to maybe go past the lighthouse and into the ocean to get a good shot. So it helps you plan your vacation that way. And that slider bar along the bottom is where you could drag it through the day and see the transit of the sun going from the rising in the east, going south and then west towards the sunset. So that allows you to plan other things, and I'll get to that in a sec. So next. And actually, I've used it to help choose my accommodations. So when Chris and I were going to Cape Breton, there was Inganish area that we wanted to go to, and there's lots of hotels and B&Bs and cabins and things like that. And I looked to try and find a cabin where we could sit out our front door and I could see both the sunrise and the sunset. And Photo Ephemeris let me do that, and that's where that pin is where we chose our cabin. And thanks to my research, and it was really great. So you can see next is this sort of a result of that. So that was basically out our front door, a few feet down the path towards the sunrise. I could tell from the app it was going to be a nice angle for where the sun was going to come up, with a nice blue hour shot. And then at nighttime we could watch the sunset. Next. And then this was just local, Anderson Road. I want to take a railway shot with the fall mist, hopefully. And so I just chose the day where the sun was going to be pretty much aligned with that railroad track. So it almost looked like a train coming at you. So it's kind of fun. And then this is where you can really use it when you're traveling. Because when you're traveling and you're in a city and there's famous buildings, you don't want the sun coming down from the top at noon hour. And you don't want it late in the day if the side of the building you want is on the other side. You're going to have it all backlit. So plan your, and in a city, you don't always know exactly where's east, where's west. I get a little turned around, and when I'm in a city, I don't know. So this was Prague. And so this way, I could use Photo Ephemeris to know, when is that light going to hit that building that I really wanted a nice shot of, so that it lights up the features, the brick, the colors, the fresco, whatever it may be, statuary. It lights it up nicely, rather than just grabbing a noon hour sun. Yeah, you'll get a shot because there's plenty of light, but it won't really highlight the building well. And then you can decide, how do I plan my day? So I'll take the next slide, please, Alan. So I go to visit my sister in Victoria, and she likes to go to Willows Beach, where there's lots of nice species of birds in the water, but she likes to go in the water. So the birds are always backlit because the Willows Beach faces east. So the first shot you saw, those are harlequin birds, and they're so pretty, and they have beautiful rust-colored feathers, but you're not going to see that because it's backlit, so it gets too dark, and I couldn't bring out the color properly. So it would have been way better for that beach if we go in the afternoon. So this is what can help you plan your day. Now, it just happened there was a little peninsula I could walk out to, shoot back towards the beach, and I caught these American widgeons. But the harlequins weren't having anything to do with it. They weren't swimming back in, so I couldn't get the harlequins. So think of that. If you know there's a beach that's got lots of wildlife or birds, don't go in the morning if the sun's rising there. Go in the afternoon when all those birds are going to be perfectly lit. Okay, and I think that is it.
Tom wants to know if there's a street view option.
Not that I'm aware of, Tom. I actually sometimes find the map in Photo Ephemeris not as much detail as I want. I will go to Google Maps and then go back and figure it out, because Google Maps will have more detail, and then, of course, it's got the street views as well.
Just a sideline on that. I think that maybe that's a feature in the pro version, but I'm not 100% sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so you can see more horizontally and see where celestial bodies will be vertically. I think I'm not sure.
The Apple app that they do have is, I forgot to mention, it's $13, so very similar to the Photo Pills one that was $15 for Androids. But the Pro, I think, is $40, but I'm not sure what all it entails. Haven't spent that money. But I do find it very useful.
Okay, thank you very much, Linda.
You're welcome.
Let's move on to another share from Chris.
Okay, this has been a work in progress for me for a number of years, actually, that it was a source of frustration that I think I've finally gotten a handle on. So if you think about all of the different devices you have, and they all have chargers that came with them, and they're all a little bit different. So, you know, you get one that came with your phone, your tablet. You know, if you got a smartwatch, it's got its own charger and things like that. So they're all designed to really charge just that single device. And you get different connectors, you get different output voltages and averages, and you end up, over time, you end up with a whole bunch of these really old ones that are really weak to charge any sort of modern device, so they become rather useless over time. So I think that what we really need is a single charger that can charge all devices. So I will give this caveat, I'm not an electrical engineer, and so if you try and do something and you electrocute yourself or fry your electronics, don't blame me. I've never had a problem with it, and I don't think you should have a problem with it, as you'll see going through it, but I cannot accept responsibility for a negative outcome. So moving on from that. So physical connections. Most modern devices are using Type-C connectors, but you will find a lot of older devices that are using USB Type-A, or you might get ones that are using the micro B or the mini B, and there are other connectors, including some proprietary connectors and so forth. So there's a whole variety of connectors on there. So for the power requirements for any particular device, smaller devices, things like phones, portable hard drives, well, actually, portable hard drives should probably not be included in here because you don't really charge them separately. Smart watches, headlamps, you know, any sort of device that is a small device, you'll usually have very low power requirements. So in most cases, I think you'll find that they take 4.5 watts or less to charge them. My smartphone uses less than 1 watt when it's charging. Larger devices, when you get into laptops and tablets and that, you get higher power requirements, and you can commonly get devices that will take up to 100 watts of power. Now, they usually will charge with much less than that, but they'll charge a lot slower. But they will take up to 100 watts, and you'll get some that go beyond 100 watts, and some can be as high as 240 watts of power. So I have a couple of things here that I'm not going to go into detail about them, but if you have USB-A, they're all 5 volts. And they draw only the current that they need. And you can see that as we go up through USB 1 through USB 3 or 3.1, it provides more current. So it goes from 100 milliamps to 900 milliamps. And then there's USB specialized, which is outside of the real standard. You can actually get up to 3 amps of power through that. On USB-C, which is what most modern devices are going to be using, you have your basic at the top, which is non-power delivery. And that is, again, 5 volts, and you'll get 1.5 or 3 amp. And then you get into the power delivery ones. And they start at 5 volts, and they go all the way up to 48 volts. And they start at 3 amps, and they typically will go up to about 5 amps. So at the top of the list, you have 48 volts at 5 amps, supplying 240 watts of power. Or the device is taking that. So I was worried about the safety of it. So I was worried if I have a charger that can output 48 volts at 5 amps and I use a smaller device on it, is it going to catch fire or melt down or destroy things? And there is no worry here because non-power delivery type devices will all use 5 volts. And they will only draw the current that they actually need. So it's not like the charger can force additional current down to the device. The device will just take whatever it needs. Once you get into power delivery devices and chargers, they're much more sophisticated. So the way it works is the power supplier or the charger advertises the power levels it can provide. So it tells all of the different amperages and voltages that it can provide. Then the device, the power consumer, sends a request for the power level it actually needs. And then the power supplier, the charger, supplies that agreed upon voltage and current. So what you're getting into now with chargers is gallium nitride, so GaN chargers. Much more sophisticated than the old silicon-based chargers. They have a lot of protections built in. So protections against overvoltage, overcurrent, short circuiting, temperature control so they don't overheat, protecting both the charger and the device that's being charged. So even very high wattage GaN chargers can work with low power devices because of the control that is going on automatically there to protect the device. So gallium nitride chargers, better efficiency and heat management and higher power capabilities than the silicon chargers they basically replace. GaN 1 was introduced in 2018, and I've highlighted the things that sort of stand out. Basic thermal management output, 30 watts to 60 watts. GaN 2, improved thermal management output to 100 watts. And it really gets it into mainstream for smartphones, tablets, laptops, things like that. GaN 3, ultra-fast charging, better thermal management on it, and it can be for anything that has over 140 watt total. So this on the chargers is when all multiple ports are in use at the same time, it could output 140 watts or more. And they can be used for anything, up to the highest wattage devices that you happen to have. There is a GaN 3 Pro, and it just basically optimizes things without introducing higher voltages and amperages. So there is one risk in all of this, and that is if you use non-E-marked cables. Hearing some noise on here, so I'm going to mute somebody.
All right.
There we go. So the thing about E-marked cables is they have an embedded chip. So that helps with all of this process. So if it's not marked as an E-marked cable, it doesn't have that chip that will communicate to the power supplier the capabilities of the cable, how much wattage it can actually handle. So it could experience unstable charging. So you get things like voltage drops and slower charging speeds and things like that. But worse is that it's possible that you get a charger supplying more current or voltage than the cable can safely handle. And the charger has no way of knowing it because there's no chip in the cable. Okay, so it can cause the cable to overheat, could possibly risk damage to both the charger and the connected device. The bottom line is that there are certified E-mark cables that are tested so that they will actually do safe power delivery. And any charger that can provide 100 watts or higher, I would always use E-mark cables if you are connecting to a device that draws 100 watts or more. If you happen to be connecting a device that's only going to draw 15 watts or something like that, then not a problem using a non-E-mark cable. But anything that's going to draw more than 100 watts, I would say always use an E-mark cable. So what I use now, I use high-powered multi-port GaN chargers, and I only use E-mark cables rated for 240 watts. Now, I don't have anything that is actually going to draw 240 watts, but I figure the cables are out there now. They're not that much more expensive than 100-watt cables or non-E-mark cables. And so I just figured this is future-proofing it for me to have all of my cables are capable of the highest power. My favorite charger now is the Topadra. And I don't know if I pasted that in. Paste it in now. So the one I use is 140-watt model. It has three USB Type-C ports. Each one can handle a maximum of 100 watts. Now, you can see that, well, if each of the Type-Cs can handle 100 watts, obviously I'm not going to get maximum power if I plug in three devices at the same time because the whole charger can only put out 140 watts. So it has those three USB Type-Cs, and it has two USB Type-As. It only costs $40 at Amazon, which is, I think, a real steal of a deal. They do have another model that goes up to 240 watts. It has four USB Type-Cs, each of which can produce can put out 140 watts on a single port. And then it has the two USB Type-As, and it costs $80 at Amazon. So here's the device. One of the things I really, really like about it is that at the top, it actually shows you the wattage that is being produced by it at any point in time or being drawn out of it by the total devices that are plugged in at any point in time. So it's kind of cool because you can plug in just single device into each of the ports. You can see what the output is, and you can very easily confirm what is the power that that device is going to draw if it is used in isolation. Now, the other thing I like about it is it's got a detachable 5-foot power cord in the back. A lot of them have prongs on the back that you just fold in and fold out. I don't like those because the charger has to actually sit in an electrical outlet, and if they're heavy, it might actually pull itself out of the socket. I actually tripped over a cord one time, and that was plugged in using prongs, and it actually bent the prongs. So I much prefer these detachable cables. So what I look for all the time when I'm guiding one of these is they should all have a chart similar to this, which shows you exactly what output you can expect depending on the devices you have plugged in. At the top, we see that it says USB ports C1, C2, and C3, which in this case are the three USB Type-C ports. They can each put out 5, 9, 12, or 15 volts at 3 amps, or they can put out 20 volts at 5 amps. And then if you look at there's various combinations. If we go down to the bottom of it, if we have all five ports are in use at the same time, so three USB, USB Type-Cs and two USB Type-As, well, the top one is going to get 65 watts. The USB C2 is going to get 30 watts maximum, and the USB C3 is going to get 20 watts. And then the USB Type-A's are each going to get 12 watts. So this can help you to decide what to plug in where. So if I have a laptop, I'm probably going to plug it into the top one. And then if I have my watch, I would plug it into maybe C3 because I know it's going to take less than 1 watt. So I wouldn't plug it into the top port as an example. Okay. And do we have any questions?
There's a question here from Natalie. She says, how does this relate to the recommendation that fast charging be avoided to help save battery life?
Yeah, this will actually supply the maximum current that the device will actually ask for. So if your device is set to actually do slow charging, then it will do slow charging because it will actually call for a lower power. But if your device is going to ask for the maximum, it's going to supply the maximum. But I think that's the case with any charger, is that it is going to supply the maximum current that the device requests.
Okay, Ed wants to know how you tell if the cable is E-marked. Is there a distinctive logo or mark on it?
I haven't seen specific logos. I have seen cases where it actually says the word E-marked. I have also seen ones that just say that it is rated for, 100 watt or 240 watt or whatever. I basically am trusting that any cable that says that it's rated for 140 watt, it is actually an E-mark cable because it's got to have that chip in it in order for it to be safe for that amount of current. So I basically am trusting it, but maybe I shouldn't be, but there are some cables that definitely do say the word E-marked.
Also, don't forget that it's not just power that cables do, it's also bits that they transmit. And I would suggest for future-proofing that you only buy USB 4 cables, because that way you can use the full 40 or 80 gigabits that it supplies or transmits.
That's true. So if you're using it for more than just charging, yeah. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that.
Bob's asking, presumably these are automatic shut-off. He says, presumably there's no need for a timer with this unit you're using?
Yeah, I've noticed that, and that's one of the things I like about the Top Adra as well. And there are the ones that have the digital display of the wattage. When my laptop is fully charged, that, you know, 100 watt, that, well, my laptops don't charge more, don't take more than about 95 watts through the USB, and it will just drop to zero. And I know that the device is fully charged when it stops drawing current.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Lots of comments on the, in the chat about various charging systems too. Okay, so next up we have a share from Steve Parker. So Steve, you unmute yourself and take it away.
Okay. What I wanted to do was to first start off with the sort of a presentation of what is involved in starting up Notebook LM. We can just go through the advantages and disadvantages first, I guess. To begin with, it's free. There is a paid version of it. What Notebook LM does is that with most devices these days, they come with manuals as a PDF or instead of a printed huge encyclopedia type thing that most people never use. You may remember RTFM, what that stood for. Even as a searchable file, manuals are still very cumbersome and not exactly user-friendly. So how about instead of a manual, you have an automatic? So, well, now we do, and it's called Notebook LM. Essentially, what you do is you load in your big honking PDF manual into Notebook LM and basically ask it, what does this button do? And it can tell you. I've done that with a lot of medical devices, and I even had a question that seemed obvious to me. I put it into Notebook LM, and it came back, and its answer was to ask tech support. So I did that. I phoned up tech support, and they sort of passed it along, and it eventually ended up to the head nurse and doctor and technician and the rest of it. And her response was that out of the last 40 years, that's the first time anybody's asked that question. And, yeah, you'd think we'd know that. And they didn't. And apparently it wasn't able to do it, which I thought was kind of strange. But they thanked me for finding something that they didn't – that should have been there that they didn't even know about. And Notebook LM essentially came up with that. With the Notebook LM – it is pretty much a fast learning curve. It's deceptively simple. You just stick in your PDF, as Ron mentions in his video, which is in that link for his car. He had a great big manual, and nobody's going to read through, you know, 1,000-page book to find out, well, how do you turn this on, or, you know, what does this dial do, or something like that. The other thing it can do is it can actually analyze lyrics in a song. I first tried it with a Beatles song, I Am the Walrus. I don't know if you've ever heard that song before, but it is complete nonsense. It's just a whole bunch of made-up words. That's what it was actually supposed to be. It didn't know what to do with that one. So I tried it with another one, which was Nick Kershaw's The Riddle. And that one I know because I've got a video of him actually explaining how all these people were coming up with what it was all about and the storyline behind it and all this sort of stuff. And people were imagining all sorts of elaborate schemes that what the lyrics were all about. And his reply to it was, no, I made the whole thing up. It's complete and utter nonsense. Yeah, it's about as made up as I Am the Walrus. But this Notebook LM was actually able to go through and get all the lyrics and sort of makes sense of it, but it didn't really catch that it was utter nonsense. Okay, so what's the next one? Yeah, there's a page limit. There isn't a page limit to the free version, but you are restricted to word count and file size and so on. Yeah, the interactive learning tools, I haven't tried yet, but apparently you can, from your PDFs or whatever sources you want to use, it can generate quizzes and flashcards. So you can, you know, have it read through it if you want, or you can read through the thing yourself, and it can actually come up with testing you on it. So it's like if you're trying to learn how to, you know, use something, or even in school, it'd be a good thing for that too. And it does tell you where, or it actually gives you a link in citations, as it says, to the information where it gets it from. Another advantage it has over just using the large language models that all the other AIs use is that you can restrict it to reduce the hallucinations, because there's less for it to have to scan through, so it's only going to take information from where or what you've assigned it to scan. And there's the link at the bottom for it. Yeah, there's actually quite a lot more. I found a lot more advantages to it than disadvantages. The one that Chris told me about that completely overlooked it altogether, that this one is a pretty significant thing, the discover sources, because what it allows you to do is if you had it set up that you were scanning just one PDF, and then you thought, well, maybe there's other stuff that it, like, I tried it on audiobooks, but then I thought, well, okay, why doesn't it, you know, reference some of the other works that this one author did? So then with this, that enables you to do that, because you can then, rather than loading in every single PDF of all the audiobooks, which for me would take rather a long time to do, you can actually have it scan sources on the internet or on your Google Drive, and it'll come up with more entries on there than any of the other AIs do, from what I've seen so far. And then you can pick and choose which ones you think are more appropriate or which ones have nothing to do with what you were looking for. That was the next one. Yeah, you can deliberately restrict it by just picking and choosing which ones you want it to use and which ones you don't. And it helps you organize. There is a thing called the mind map, which I haven't tried yet, but it does help you organize and spark new insights, as it says. You can also share it with other people, the notebooks that you come up with. It can create audio overviews of your PDFs or even the MP3s that you put in. It can generate podcasts based on it. And you can actually jump in as though it's a live podcast and ask them questions in the middle of it, which I thought was kind of cool. There's also a YouTube video overview, which, okay, most of the other AI things can do that too. And it generates, says there, the mind map and the reports. It supports PDFs and MP3s and text files and Google Docs. The slides, I think it does do the Google slides, but it doesn't seem to do the PPTX, whatever the latest ones are. You can add web pages into it and, of course, YouTube videos. And I found out that it doesn't take up space on your Google Drive unless you want to use a source that you've put on your Google Drive. And then you don't have to worry about it filling up your allotment for the Google Drive space. There aren't really all that many disadvantages that I found were, of course, you have to have a Google account and you have to have an internet connection for it to work. Limited customization is not really that big an issue because this thing does so much that once you get started with it, you realize, oh, I didn't know it could do that. Or, you know, or you overlook that you can add sources to it and it can do this and it can do that. It's like, wow. So limited customization, it's probably a good thing, actually, because it's already information overload to begin with. And the quality of the output, yeah, that's essentially garbage in, garbage out. It does have a potential for amplifying biases because, depending on how limited you make the source material. But, I mean, all AIs are going to be like that anyway, so that's no big deal either. The privacy concerns, are only really an issue if you put sensitive material in there. For the most part, you're putting PDF manuals in there. That's what I see as the main use of it that most people are going to be doing with it. For that, it really doesn't matter. Or even MP3 files. Most of the stuff I had were music or audiobooks. I didn't create them, and I certainly didn't put any banking information or anything in them. So,
hey, Steve, I can interrupt. We are past 8:30 now, so if you hope to do a demo at all, better speed it along.
All right, well, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
It's basically what we've got there, and the only, apart from the limits on it, the only other thing was that if you wanted the paid version, you have to have the Google One AI premium subscription, which I imagine Ron has, but I didn't really need it. And that's pretty much it for advantages and disadvantages that I was able to get. There's probably a whole slew more that I haven't covered, but as Chris just said, we're running out of time, so. If I can just show you what the if I can get to a share. There we go.
Chris, are we carrying on or what here?
You can do it quickly there, Steve.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get to. I'm just making sure I get the right one. Yeah, okay, great. There we go. There's the Tech for Seniors. Oop, was. What happened there? Okay. There we go. There's what, when you go to the Google LM notebook, getting flashes for some reason. Is it blanking on and off on your...
Nope.
Okay. What I've done was that was the book that I put in with folded hands. That one I found was appropriate for this because what it was a book written by Jack Williamson in 1950. And it was just after World War II. So it was about robots. And he has them keep humans safe. The only problem with that is that they do such a good job that they don't allow humans to do virtually anything at all that's dangerous. So no sports or anything. So essentially humans just become prisoners, well looked after. And it basically just said that in their description that it goes through. You can then ask a whole series of questions and it uses that source or you can add to it. This was what I used for the medical stuff so that I could see. Let's click on it anyway. I'll bring it up. I tried the Discover sources and this is all the stuff that was added to it. And I can then pretty much ask it any question I needed to find answers to, like how do I do whatever thing I was looking for. And then over on the other side, you've got the outputs where it can produce the quizzes, the flashcards, mind map, the audio overview, and everything else. And that was pretty much it.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Early in the chat, if anybody's interested, there's some links to some videos on YouTube by Ron, and he does very effective demonstration on the power of it, how you can actually do it, and set up your sources and how you can get your output. So if anybody's interested, I highly recommend looking very early in the chat from tonight, and there'll be links in there for that.
Yeah, okay. If anybody has any questions, fire away.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that we really need to cover here, just some comments about privacy and things like that. So, again, people can check out the chat afterwards. And I guess we'll turn back to Alan.
Okay, thanks. So setting you up for the weekend, Stuart Bruce has provided this link to House Creep, which is a collection of places where various criminal activities were known to have happened, including hauntings and all kinds of wonderful things. So apparently you can search any city, and Canadian cities are included. So check out all the bad things that happened in your neighborhood from this link right here. Okay, so we're running a little bit late, so let me just quickly go through the wrap up and we'll pass that. We're always interested in links, and especially Canadian links. So if you have a Canadian website that you found of interest, let us know, and we'll feature it as a Loony link. Coming up at the library, Chris is going to be doing PC Tips in Orleans on Thursday, which is tomorrow. Linda is going to tell you how to restore old photographs, not necessarily fix them for you, apparently. At Cumberland on Saturday, and artificial intelligence tips at Greenborough on Tuesday. The event is full, but Chris always says that there's always room for people because there are always no-shows. So if you're interested in that at Greenborough, just show up.
Otherwise, by all means.
Otherwise, go to the link there and register for whatever sessions you're interested in. And this is just a few sessions. There are lots of sessions, lots more sessions available online. Our November meeting is coming up, and we're going to be featuring home automation, just an introduction by Bill James from Oklahoma City. And so that's going to be in 2 weeks on November the 12th, so mark your calendar. But next week will be just our next Q&A session. So if you have questions or follow-up answers on things that we've discussed tonight, topics that you'd like to share, like Linda and Steve tonight, so thanks both to Linda and Steve for their contributions. If you have topics you'd like to share or questions, just send us a note to the suggestion box, and we'll be happy to add you to the agenda. So I hope everybody enjoyed the things tonight. You've still got time to see the end of the Blue Jays game. Hope they win, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.